Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. Who's here?
I'm Richard Lovejoy.
Richard, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I just received your bio. Thanks very, very much. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
I'm going to send out all the bios now that I have them, and we're going to spend a small portion of our initial seminar getting each of you to introduce yourselves. We have a terrific group of professionals. We have a small group, which is great because we'll have a bit more time at the beginning of each of the trainings to look at any challenges you have from the curriculum, from work with clients. So I'll always preserve a bit of time at the beginning. And then as we get into the material later, in the seminars, I'm going to get each of you to present a roadmap case study on yourself or on a client. I'm going to send a link for an ebook to each of you that has a number of the roadmap case studies, but we're not going to do any of that until we actually go over the steps of the roadmap. So welcome. Any questions so far about any housekeeping things from anyone?
The only question I have is I'm started with, I'd love to do the new life story as well as the new money story, but I decided to start on the money story first. So I'll do the new life next.
Well, I think wait and see what you find in this experience because even though we focus on money story, the same principles and issues and the roadmap system is a way of deconstructing and understanding a story and constructing a new one, whether that's a life, money, wellness, career, or relationship story. There are going to be aspects of that throughout. So I'd say it's a good call to hold off and see where you are at the end of this training and see what you think at that point. So
excellent.
So good call on that. Who else has joined? Is Thomas here?
Hey, Dr. Dave. It's Tom from Connecticut. How are you?
Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Excellent. I'm going to get each of you, as I mentioned, to introduce yourselves. Is Kim from the UK here? I'm sorry, from South Africa. Well, good that she didn't hear that slip. Okay. I'll have to check on the time zone and the use of the world clock there. She may not know about daylight saving time. Anyhow, let's begin, and I'll get each of you to introduce yourself. Richard, would you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what brought you here, what you want to do with coaching, and how you'd like to use this material?
Certainly. Well, first of all, I'm 73 going on 3. When
okay.
I was 65,
you're
I truncated
the right
decade
direction.
Number. Yeah, so I live between the ages of 0 and 9. So I have over 50 years of business experience since graduating from UC Berkeley in 68. And the interesting thing is I got a Bachelor of Arts degree in accounting, not a Bachelor of Science, but a Bachelor of Arts in accounting. And I was a CPA, CEO, CFO, COO, CCO, Chief Creative Officer, and a CHO, the Chief Happiness Officer, for many different companies. And I just wasn't fulfilled in terms of what I was doing. As much as we were helping other people, it just wasn't for me. So my wife and I met 26 years ago in 1991, and that's an interesting story in and of itself. And we started it's called a New Leaf Company, and we help, we consult, we coach, we mentor small business clients anywhere from $50,000 in revenues up to $10 million. And we help them in many different ways. We're both ordained ministers as well because we feel that it's important to bring the spiritual component into your life. Into all of your stories because it turned out to be very critical for me in terms of fulfilling myself and being who I truly want to be. In 1943, I was born, and my father, 6 months later, left to go into the Second World War and was gone for 3 years, and he was my first mentor. And I really lost contact with him. He came back. However, our sister was born within a year after he came back. And then I had an uncle who was Jewish, and he was a very successful businessman in the San Francisco Bay Area. And he agreed that he would mentor me. He would help me. So we sat down and had a meeting, and we agreed that I would set a goal. So I said, okay, you're a millionaire, Marshall. I'd like to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. Well, that was great and everything, but 2 weeks later, my uncle died. So I worked for small, closely held Jewish companies after graduating from Berkeley, trying to recreate that relationship with my uncle, as opposed to doing the inner work, and which I've since done. But so having a mentor to me, having a coach, has always been very important to me, and it's been a lifelong search for me. I'm finally reconciled with that, and now I want to become a mentor and much more of a coach than I am. What's missing in my money story is I need a new money story. I need to take those things out of my old money story, my old life story, and recreate new things and bring the things in that have worked for me and then create a completely new money story. And this thing like rang a bell for my wife and I, who is going to be working with me in terms of this.
Okay. Now, would your wife be involved in listening to the seminars or reading the what is her level of involvement with you in terms of this training?
Well, in effect, she'll be reading the stuff with me and going along with me, because we're going to be creating the business together.
Okay.
Now, what I hope to create in terms of this training is I want to create focus, clarity, a sense of peace, and allow myself to do my work in a much easier and effortless way, to have my true self move more and more into place and into doing what I'm doing and being.
Okay.
So the plan to use it is by creating a mentoring and coaching practice that allows others to create and implement their new money and life stories, and then help them do that, and in effect also for us to be able to create that for ourselves.
And this primarily will be in your clients who own and operate small businesses?
Well, in effect, we're looking to expand that.
Okay, got it.
We have about 70 clients now across the United States. We're probably in about 30 different states, and most of our clients we've never met, so we just... It's all by word of mouth. We don't have a website. We don't advertise. We've never done anything like that.
That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
so
that sounds great. Welcome. Exciting stuff.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's great to have
and
you.
I am ready to go in terms of creating this new story and doing this work.
Okay,
and this
terrific.
Play.
What part of California is Rohnert Park?
Rohnert Park is in the Sonoma Valley.
Oh, okay.
So we're about 50 miles north of San Francisco.
Yeah, okay.
And we're in the southernmost part of Sonoma's the next valley over, and then two valleys over is the Napa Valley.
Got it. Okay, yeah, I'm familiar with that area. I just wasn't familiar with the town. I'm about to be in the Redwoods area around San Rafael doing a three-day retreat there in June on New Money Story. So
really?
Well, welcome. That sounds
Is that an open thing, or is that you doing that for?
No, that's open. It's 1440 Multiversity. Are you familiar with Omega Institute out of Rhinebeck, New York?
Yes, I am.
The founders of that group and many of the people who financed it have started a new group in a new retreat in California. They have like 100 acres in the Redwoods. It's supposed to be a fantastic place to have weekend retreats, and I was invited to be one of the initial presenters there for a three-day retreat I think somewhere around June 27th, that weekend there. I'll send you some information.
Thank you. I would love that. I would love to attend.
Trek up from the wine country.
Yes.
Okay. Tom, what about you?
Great. Thank you, Dave. My name's Tom. I'm from Connecticut. I'm 46. I started my professional career off as a clinical social worker in a family service agency. I moved on to a school social worker position and then studied to be a public school administrator, which I've been doing now for, I think I'm in my 12th year. Recently, about 6 months ago, I started doing some per diem work for Hartford Healthcare as a addiction clinician, substance abuse clinician, working in their detox, residential, and evening outpatient programs. You know, what led me to coaching, I think, is as I look forward over the next 3, 6, 9, 10 years of my life, I'm starting to look at developing a new skill set, perhaps starting my own business. I'm very interested in counseling. I think what's drawing me to coaching is working with individuals who perhaps have experienced a little more success or who have maintained success in their life differently than the clients I'm working with 10, 15 years ago in a family service agency or as a social worker in a school system or even now as a clinician around substance abuse. So I think I'm looking to change my work a little bit while still helping people.
What kind of focus would you ideally like to have in a mentor coaching practice, Tom?
Well, see, I'm here now because I think personal money coaching is definitely a service. If I thought about a coaching practice and thought about the portfolio of services I might want to offer or the niche that sometimes I hear people talk about finding, you know, finding that client that you want to work with or finding the type of work you want to do, I think money coaching is very interesting. I don't see a lot of people doing that out there. If I think about coaching on a continuum or counseling, on one end being all about the numbers, maybe your CPAs or your financial advisors, and then on the other end of that continuum being more the emotional side of it, I think I'm interested in maybe tilting more towards the emotional side of money. I think you said it once in one of your seminars that if money was just about math, none of us would have debt. and I think that's so true. I think, you know, many of our decisions, especially around money, has a lot to do with the emotional part of us.
Okay.
So what I hope to gain from this training is a good foundation, a content, or you know, a lot of content knowledge, and also some reflection and growth on my own end in terms of how I might use this moving forward.
Okay. There's a group that you might be interested in called the Financial Therapy Association.
Someone recommended that to me last night.
I was having
this conversation.
They basically don't quite know what to do with financial coaches. I've been a member for 3 or 4 years. I joined when they asked me to do a keynote for their second meeting, and there's not exactly a category for coaches, but they're kind of working on that. But they're an interesting organization. It's mostly therapists who do financial therapy, but there are other people there too. Well,
great.
You're welcome. That sounds great. Sounds like some interesting applications.
Thank you.
Let me go back and check. Has Kim arrived from Johannesburg?
I have. Thank you.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks very much.
You sound great. You sound like you're next door. Are you on a computer phone, a landline?
I'm actually using my cell phone because my landline wouldn't work.
No kidding. Okay. I worked with a client fairly recently, and the only connection we could do was by cell phone, but FaceTime audio. So, but you're sounding great. Usually cell phones don't work really good with teleconferences in the States, and this one is no different, but you sound great. Would you introduce yourself? Tell us a bit about yourself and your journey to be with us today.
Okay, my name's Kim. I'm a wife and a mother of three children. I'm a financial planner, so what I do every day is have conversations with my clients around their money. But I would call myself a financial planner with a difference. I did the qualification in the States called life planning with somebody called George Kinder about 8 years ago, and I've been doing work with somebody else called Mitch Anthony, also from the States. And I now facilitate conversations with my clients around their life before we talk about their money. And once we know what they want from their life, we then look at their money and see how their money can enable their life. In the course of this time, I've written a book on the subject, more to do with how people can plan their retirements and get meaning from their money. And where I'm being led now is to maybe deepen my conversation, and that's how I came across your work, and I'm hoping being on the course is going to give me some exercises I can do with clients to deepen that relationship with money.
Terrific. What's the name of your book?
Retirement, M-E-A-N-T. I actually have sent you a copy. I'm not sure when it's going to get to you.
Oh, terrific. Thank you very much. I'm excited to have that. Is it in other languages than English?
No, I only wrote it in English.
Okay.
And at this time, mainly, it's been available in all the bookstores in South Africa, but it is available on Kindle as well.
Oh, okay. Terrific. Okay.
What's that available on?
Say it again.
On the Kindle.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Super. You mentioned about the client workbook. There are some things I want to just sort of go over in terms of housekeeping to be sure that you have access to all the resources that you really can use. You saw the link that I sent and each of the two letters, the one today, that link is to the page that has the download for the outline for each of these 12 seminars. It's a fairly annotated outline, and the important things that I go over in the presentation will be on that outline, so you don't have to take a whole lot of notes. You can kind of listen to see if it makes sense. There's also a syllabus of which specific parts of the curriculum will correspond with each of the 12 seminars. There's also a 28-week protocol. There are a number of people who have done the training who wanted to do groups particularly and have assignments in the client workbook that would correspond to the weeks for coaching. So you'll see that as a way of thinking about if you want to use that, if you have any use for that, it can be expanded or contracted to fit with a client or with a group. Now,
great.
I'm going to send each of you a copy of the client workbook at the conclusion of our training as my compliments. This is something that will give you an idea of what it would be like to work with a client in the workbook. All the content of the workbook is within the curriculum that you have. It's in gray. It appears in gray so that it can be placed to correspond with suggested use, but I'll send you a copy of the workbook per se. And you've seen a picture of it, seen the contents of it on the landing page for this training. It'll give you an idea of what it would be like to work with clients. What I found, and what some clients have found, some coaches have found most recently, is instead of making it a hard copy for clients, the very easiest way to do this, to co-brand this as part of a benefit to further your practices, would be to have, I can have my graphics person redo the cover to co-brand it with your name on the cover and a new first page, and can set it up so that it can be downloaded and printed immediately by your client whenever you sign somebody on. So what that means is it can, you can work with anybody in the world in that way, because it's all digital, and you can work with a group, for example, in different locations. You just, you know, send them the download of the workbook, and then you get together like we are here. And it's a very simple process. For all the products, you would get a rebate because of being, and I only do affiliate status with people who I've trained, New Life Story Wellness Coaches, New Money Story Mentors, and you purchase the one-time download of a work of the client workbook that's co-branded with your name on it, and then send it to your client at retail. So you've immediately made some profit, but it's instantly available to your client as a PDF, and they print it and work with you on it. So if you're interested in that, that has been has worked really terrifically in many instances.
No, absolutely. So, great. That's great.
Great, Dave. And we could do that at a later date, like, you know, let's say 3-6 months after taking the class, or is that something we have to act on immediately?
No. You can do it whenever you're ready. What I would suggest is wait until we've done maybe the first 5 or 6 of the seminars, because that's going to be a focus on the principles of the roadmap system. We're going to spend our first seminar today on your money story, and then the next 4 seminars we're going to spend on the roadmap system. It's the acronym for the 7 steps to deconstruct a story and construct or revise a new one. And we'll focus on money story, but you can use it for any of the components of life, wellness, career, relationship that you want. So
great.
You'll be able to work. I encourage you to work with clients as soon as you're ready, and that will give us some material if you're interested in bringing aspects of that to focus on in our seminars.
Great.
As soon as you're ready to do this, I mean, basically it is limited to only used by people who have trained with me, who are licensed and specialty certified. And the things that I do to maintain the license, in other words, to maintain your ongoing continuing education, include, as you've probably read, a registry for individual and corporate referral with your information, specialty, message, picture, and all that, a quarterly mentor group where we all get together and talk about success stories. It's pretty inspirational to hear people all over describe what they're doing, and it's very stimulating to get ideas. And I also, as part of that, send out a white paper. So it's a continuing education aspect as well. And I'm available for whatever help. I reserve a priority time and fee for any mentor coaching for people who train with me. So that's always available, and I'll be here to help you in whatever way I can. I only train a small number of people per year because I really spend time devoting to enhancing your practices and that sort of thing. So there are other related, like the CD series and the workbook for your new money story roadmap, that will be available to you if you want to do that, and that's available also in an all digital instead of CDs. So all of that, I don't want to confuse you or inundate you with too much stuff. I'm going to send a letter at the end of the training that carefully reviews all of that and the steps. is just a preface, and anything you're interested in, we can talk about, or you can email me about. But I'll do that all in the end so that it's not confusing, and we just focus on the real fun stuff, the learning on the front end. Okay, so each seminar will meet for 75 minutes, so be ready with any of your challenges or issues to brainstorm, and I'll reserve some time at the beginning and the end for discussion. I'm going to put us on lecture mode just for the middle part for the presentation. Every seminar is recorded, is just accessible to our group. In other words, you can present material about a client, keep it anonymous, of course, but only our group will have access to the recordings, but the recordings will be available usually within 24 hours. And any issues or questions you have, my IT guy is support@mentorpath.com. His name is Bill, and he'll have that posted within 24 hours.
Okay.
So, yes, go ahead.
No, I was just saying great.
Oh, okay. Questions?
Dave, can I ask a question, please?
Please.
With your work, if we don't want to use necessarily the entire workbook and we take out just aspects of it and we refer to you, are you happy with that?
There is a component. There is another product that is just the roadmap plus the money story. And that focus is just on money story without anything else, and that's a separate product, and that can be set up digitally as well. Now, there are only a couple of instances where I've had people do what you're talking about doing and combining it with other stuff, and what we've worked out is a license to do that, but I really work to preserve the MentorPath brand for all of us. So nobody chops it up or does a little bit or adds a little bit on, because it reflects on all of us. And I passionately preserve our brand and our brand integrity, because that is part of what each of you are becoming part of, is the MentorPath family. And I call the quarterly mentor groups reunions, and I work very hard to preserve that. So I don't give permission to, you know, chop it up and use it in various ways. Does that answer your question?
So what you're saying is we could discuss this after I've done the course if, for me, there's other things that I do already and I want to add to it, but then we'll do it on a case-by-case basis.
Sure. I'll be happy to do whatever can facilitate your work. But, yeah, let me know, and we'll be happy to discuss that.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Now, the only requirement for certification other than attendance is a brief case write-up using the roadmap system. And I'll send you, as I mentioned, a link for an ebook that is a compilation of roadmap case studies. One of the five sections is money stories. It's a compilation. I think there are 32 case studies. Various people who have trained with me found that it was so useful to do that I ultimately made it a requirement and put together the ebook so that this could enhance the practices for them and for anybody who trains with me. So I'm going to send you a link that you can share with clients if they want an idea of what you're up to or an idea of what the roadmap system can do to look at examples in there. And I think you'll see some interesting examples. There are five sections, and I introduce and annotate each section. I've had it professionally edited, and my graphics person has done a cover. It's a neat ebook. It's long for an ebook, but it's got a bunch of stuff in it, and somebody can just look at what they want or print a section of it or whatever. And I'm going to send you that, and feel free to use that for your marketing purposes if you think it would be useful. Send them that link, and they can go to it and immediately download the ebook. Questions now.
Okay. How many weeks is this course? Is it 28?
12.
12. Okay. 12
yeah.
Weeks.
The 28-week protocol is the suggestion of the exercises and work tools to use in individual or group work, assuming maybe a 7 to 9 month engagement.
Okay.
So, but this is 12 seminars, 75 minutes each.
Right. And that's once a week at this time?
Exactly. Same time each week.
Perfect.
Other questions or any housekeeping things?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and then we'll come back at the end for discussion.
Okay.
Okay. You see, one of the downloads was the introduction and some of the things that I am not spending time going over. You can see a copy of that as you print it out. So what I want to begin to focus on in terms of a prologue for our work is that my goal is to create a collaborative learning alliance and develop group wisdom. The first session, we'll talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new money story. The remaining seminars, we'll look at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change, beginning with the foundation of the 7-step roadmap process to create a new money story. We'll talk about your money story. Now, I encourage you to do the exercises and work pages in the client workbook, and that's the portion in gray in your curriculum. I want to encourage you to actively understand and work on your own story to apply the process. When you've done it for yourself, I think you'll be in the best position to do mentor coaching with it. When you've made your own journey, you can best guide your client's journey. So, to begin, write down this question. What's my money story? I'd suggest you schedule a brainstorming session for yourself, maybe at least 15 or 20 minutes, no interruptions, to think about your money story. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines. Now, your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, net worth. It's your money story. So, let's talk about this whole concept. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, is remarkably simple, yet intricately complex at the same time. This story has an internal and external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You may get 10 years out of a car, maybe 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. When I spoke with a well-known self-help guru, his response was, you know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change. It captured in a very elegant way the simplicity of how difficult and challenging it is. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of your life. From what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink, are all impacted. At times, you've used this story to regulate your moods, increase your self-esteem, even influence others. And how you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients. What they see in your behavior and hear as your beliefs will be what they incorporate as their own. And here's the lifeline clue. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all people of the world. It speaks to you, you speak with it. Of course, it's your money story. So let's look a little bit more closely at what is a money story. As I mentioned, it's not your income, expenses, assets, debt. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story includes the secret language of money. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you believe you're capable of. It also may include what would happen if you had more or less. So let's think about some of the ways that we actually speak with money. First, we speak in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. The wonder of money is it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, also at times for what we fear and lack, or what we covet, crave, spurn, or chase, or follow. We use money at times to show how much we care or how little. We can use it to measure success or try to buy happiness, to try to bolster self-esteem, regulate moods. In other words, we use money to communicate. Now, we also speak with money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it really is. We use money as a self-statement, and money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements, and the story always tells most about the teller. Here are some of those self-statements that are possible. And this is the tip of the iceberg. Proclamation of freedom, a currency of caring, a promissory note for happiness, the embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, instrument of control. An example is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a bright red BMW 550 and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a bright red BMW 550 in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, of course, that's not a self-statement. I never buy a bright red BMW. So without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. We also use money in self-talk, the message we tell ourselves. These internal beliefs may include people who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money might really buy happiness. We have external and internal dialogues about our money. Let's consider first the external dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money in part a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. For example, we can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? and you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have, and you may not see dessert. An agent at a writer's conference discussed working with her authors over the years. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. Someone in the audience asked, would you talk about, and there probably two-thirds of the meeting time had already elapsed, and we were all engaged with her. It was an internationally known agent, but she had totally avoided the subject of money and contracts. Somebody, not me, finally said, would you talk about how much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? She looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself, and an older guy, again from the back row, and again not me, said, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course, he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion that was really useful to her audience, most of whom were interested in writing books for a living. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. That was exactly a century and 4 years ago, the therapist Sigmund Freud. More than a century later, most of us have learned to talk more easily about sex, yet remain seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own money stories. The first book I did about money had this quote from Freud in the front flap. It was a book to other professionals. It was in the late 80s. The book was called The Last Taboo, Money, a Symbol in Reality, in Psychoanalysis. And guess who had this seasoned wisdom? When we don't speak of something, we make it more powerful. That was Harry Potter. Now, let's consider the internal dialogue. While we may not speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, which is to say our time and energy, for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, can have many dialects. Some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton for my dad on hot summer days. School started, I saw my classmates enjoying sodas and candy. I immediately joined them, and my treats were quickly gone. I immediately asked, was that candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? Was that Coke worth an entire row of chopping cotton? Immediately, I answered no to both questions. Family farms were below the radar of child labor laws back then. But it also ushered in a concept that I've written about since, about something that we may not always consider as parents. We look at the value of money and how to spend and how to help our children, look at being discerning and being responsible. But it also introduces the idea of the cost of money. Money always costs something. That helped me realize what money costs. Money costs a half a row of chopping cotton. Money costs a full row of chopping cotton. There were equivalents. Now, another example. At an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. One more example. The preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on an HD big screen TV, but if I amortize it over the next 9 years, it only costs 22 cents a day. And my wife said, Dave, if you want the TV, let's just go ahead and get it. That's an example of rationalized spending. Now, a sidebar. alongside your outline summary from Module 4, in the outline section, when you printed that, at the back of the Module 4, there's a separate page called the ABCs of Money Mistakes and Financial Fallacies. There are, I believe, 27 listed, and I'm going to illustrate each of these over the next 12 seminars. And I'll just mention sort of parenthetically when I do, just as I did rationalized spending. Another example, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained at times. Found money can be consumed frivolously. George Costanza said, "This is found money. I got to blow it on a horse." Gifted money can be spent without debate. Salary money or professional fees used only after serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement money relinquished only with definite need or emergency. And it's the same dollar. It doesn't know who owns it any more than war bonds knew about the war. This is a framing bias. Money is treated differently based on the framework surrounding it, based on its context. Here's a quote from a documentary from a veteran of three bankruptcies on the verge of her fourth. "The high from shopping is still more powerful than the low from bankruptcy." And one final example, the parent. "I spend so much time at work. When I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it," a justification bias. And consider how money speaks to us. A study in which volunteers had their brain scans using fMRI scans when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. They were told, before tasting, the price of each of the wines. They rated the wines, and as you might expect, did that according to price. The most expensive one they liked the best, and on down, the least expensive one the last. And their brains corresponded. The area of their brains that encode the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the most expensive wine. Same wine, different stories. The volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure, and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. So sometimes money communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. It can speak to us in any way, confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, drug. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. Our core beliefs require a portal for expression. Our various behaviors are a path to the tangible. And money is a concretized tangible. So let's look then at money equations. And think about this when you're, for example, working with a family, or let's make it easy, working with a couple. And one of the couple has money wired at a brain level to equal freedom. So money equals pleasure and the freedom of being able to spend and the expression of being able to do that for oneself and for others. For the other partner, money is wired as security. So pleasure is being able to save money, to accumulate money, to amass what represents security. So with two different meanings, two different brain equations of money, the work is creating a common ground and looking at compromise. So money can make any statement: worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. And a desire is not quieted by its satisfaction. And as marketers know, desires can be created by filling them. Money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper, only a piece of paper. But when offered the chance to imbue that design with meaning, the interpretations are going to be as wishful and varied as the fantasies of each of the respondents. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth or even their morals. One woman said, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps you money. Or even equated with their ethics. President Obama said early on, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, we know better than that. You may work hard, but you may overspend, gamble, have four kids, three of whom are college age, live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction, just to name a few. Now, here's a question I want you to think about. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic? Of all the cultures, groups, occupations, who in America has the best work ethic? Jot down who you think or what you think is the answer. If you're ready for the answer, here it is. Heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, plus holidays, 365 days a year. One heroin addict put it this way. I can't let a single day go by without working. If I don't get up to crack of dawn and work all day, it's not like the next day my self-esteem suffers. The next day I die. So I mention this to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic or especially success ethic. Think about somebody you've heard, man, I was at my desk 10 hours today. You know, I put in a lot of work. That's great for work ethic, but even more important is performance and success ethic. What did you do? What were you successful at? So, why do we make these money errors? The more we give money meaning, the more we lose focus on what money really means, and then we do strange things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed sometimes repeatedly. I've worked with two Madoff victims, for example. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Think about that one. Otherwise, gifted people may not convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise, balanced people may spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Dependable people can ignore financial matters until they're serious. Otherwise, highly principled individuals step over boundaries and write their own rules. I'm from Houston, home of Enron, home of Stanford. Others are taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of CyberNet, common investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that can imprison them until they're listened to, understood, and revised. Now, money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands, our broker's hands, but inside our minds, in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, neurological wiring. So here's a 22-second history of money, since you ask. First, a couple of goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. And then, coins that had metal value of what they represented. Then, coins were replaced by paper bills that represented an equivalent amount of gold. Then paper bills that were simply reserve notes. Then paper checks. Then plastic. Then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money's become more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money fades, and our relationship with it changes. Think about a very simple principle of this. When you go into a casino, and admit you have, when you go into a casino, you immediately change your real money to chips, because it's not like you're betting $5 or $25. You're betting the green chip or the black chip, and we have an easier time when it's symbolized like that instead of actually $5 that we have to think about, man, I work for that. An example of the shadow side. I heard Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, present studies that show two conditions that increase cheating behavior. The more people are removed from actual money, more abstraction, such as dealing with derivatives like options and mortgage-backed securities, and recall the complex instruments Madoff and Stanford dealt with. Even other money managers said they didn't know exactly what they were doing with them. And secondly, a social environment where you see cheating around you. And we'll talk later about social contagion. So money is a way of thinking we know exactly what we're getting. We think we know what money is by what it can do for us, as if it will guarantee our expectations. So let's look at some mind matters and brain business. What's the role of mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? Well, the answer is everything to start with. So, first question, why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will they repeat behavior that doesn't work, sometimes do it harder, and expect a different result, even when it may lead to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationship? Nassim Taleb asks in his book, The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to that question of why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure. It's predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting and even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's a default model. It's what we do again and again without even thinking about it. We repeat because we know how it'll turn out, and it creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. And the easiest and fastest way to end that discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means their home base of reality, their internal map that's synonymous with identity. This is huge, and we're going to return to that, because the most powerful force of the human psyche is that we return to our identity. So if we make changes or do something different, unless we also address a transformation of the model that we're operating on, will revert back, and change won't be permanent. So let's do a brief exercise. Put your palms together firmly and interlock your fingers very firmly. Clasp your hands together like that and keep them there. Notice what thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, firmly clasped together, and change your thumb so that the other one's on top. How does that feel? Kind of goofy, kind of awkward. Now, move your thumbs back to the original position. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We'll talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he'd be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path, Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its circuitous route. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. The same thing happened when he made it increasingly circuitous with diabolical turns. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, early behavior, and attachment patterns, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require more work. So to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. Catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, new context, appreciative inquiry by a mentor coach, questions that help to focus and look at possibility. So we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engage new behavior. So it's literally like the superhighway of the familiar in your brain. You're traveling easily by the default mode. It may not be getting you to exactly where you want to go, but the travel sure is easy. And all of a sudden, you stop, you leave that superhighway, you take a machete to a trail that is not yet cut, and it's not easy, even though it may be going more directly to where you want to go. So that's the discomfort. That's the greater work that we have to go through to create something new and different. So this is the juncture we're going to talk about when your mind and brain react to leaving that familiar. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as discomfort of evidence not to proceed, intuition of the wrong choice. This is where we need to help a client accurately read their discomfort rather than an intuition that this is the wrong way to do things or their gut telling them it's a wrong choice. This is simply the discomfort of trying something new and different, of departing their comfort zone. And they can discern the difference when looked at carefully of that feeling, because this feeling about doing something new and different is not exactly, it's not qualitatively the same kind of anxiety as an old model where danger, anxiety equals danger, better head for cover. This is an anxiety that's coupled with or infused with an excitement, a kind of exploratory newness that is exciting even though it's uncomfortable in the beginning. And to really recognize that, we can help a client reframe this experience as a signpost that they're moving ahead, validation that they're in new territory. So the reframing of this becomes a part of that internalization of evolving their identity with the changes they make so the changes will last. Now, the principle here, one of the principles, discomfort and uncertainty began any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. We'll talk later about how to use this error detection mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, we struggle to embrace change. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how our minds and brains work. But neuroscience, quantum physics, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, and strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operations. At times, our minds and brains can work against us. When we think with one part of the brain and feel with another, we need a map. So we're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change and guide strategies of change. We're going to use emotional economics, my trademark concept, to inform money decisions, even at times to outsmart our brains. We can reprogram our minds to rewire our brains to create wealth and success. So a last question here. How do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? Well, the brain has a mind of its own, and we're of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional magnetic resonance imaging. It's actually a video of the brain in action, as you know, as it responds to different situations. These studies have disproven the long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses that they choose based on logic, traditional economics. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways, behavioral economics and neuroeconomics. Money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activities. We're going to use these findings to help us inform certain decisions. Here's just a glimpse of some examples. The prefrontal cortex says, let's think about the 12-month game plan and retirement savings. The limbic system says, let's have that second cognac and order that 27-inch iMac. And my amygdala even specifies the brand of cognac, actually single malt scotch, and does an excellent pairing with cigars. So I have a very specialized amygdala. Each part struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Another, emotions don't simply and only corrupt decision-making. Emotions narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate. But those who feel no emotions are not good at decision-making. It requires a balance. Making people happy is not simply them having more of what they want. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to the new stimuli and expects it to consider the hedonic treadmill, that it takes more and more to have the same modicum of pleasure. David Geffen put it very simply. He said, anyone who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. When someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and smartness, and it could be. And gamblers interpret good fortune as skill. My wife and I play heads-up poker. She finally asked me, said, would you like me to tell you one of your tells? And I said, absolutely, I'll take all the help I can get. She said, whenever you draw a really lucky hand, you have a slightly smug look that you think you're brilliant. No, that's true. The most important thing about your money story, and this is very simple, to discern what works and what doesn't work. That's the basic principle of mentor coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. The components that work don't need fixing. They may need enhancing. The ones that don't work need to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life stories, and to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. Money is a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money will make them more drunk. If somebody's insecure, money may make them more paranoid. If somebody's caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. So, it is not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. Our money stories are a large part of our life stories. Stories awaken emotion, and money resonates with the most basic emotions. And think about how we personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer relationship and assign causality. We live our money stories each day. We make monetary transactions. The themes may be unstated, but they're evident in every transaction. Some of the money issues are really about money, but most are about other matters, private or even secret, that hitchhike on money. We write our money stories, live them, can revise them, or write new money stories. We're going to learn how you can strategically rewire your brains and reprogram your minds to create wealth and success. And the most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and the beliefs that drive behavior and decisions. Money is portal to the immaterial and the intangible. So we begin a journey, a systematic approach to the principles and practice of mentor coaching. And you write each of your stories, live them, revise them, and can write informed, powerful new ones. So we're in discussion mode. Let's look at questions, thoughts, reflections on anything that you heard. I'm interested in your thoughts and your take on this, your question.
It's a comment. This is Richard. That was just amazing. That is just so much information, and I'll probably be listening to it every day.
Well, you know, I do kind of struggle with, I really prefer a true seminar, the give and take and discussion, but there's also so much I want to convey and apply in addition to the curriculum. I didn't mention, but I won't be reiterating what's in the curriculum, but I want to apply and extend it, and there's so much that that I want to convey. It's always a dilemma because I'd rather discuss and hear from each of you, but I also want to convey a lot too. So thanks for your comments. I hope it was helpful. Other thoughts?
It was meaningful. Thank you.
Thanks. Other thoughts or questions? So let's think about really extending and applying the material and applications in mentor coaching. I'll look for additional materials and research. Let's think about case studies. If you have a case, a challenge, a vignette, let's talk about it. I'll bring in ones that may apply to what we're doing and the illustrations that would help you, and I'm open to suggestions of what kind of things that you'd like us to discuss and would be beneficial to look at.
Now, what would you like us to be doing for this next week?
What I'd suggest is that you look at the syllabus has the corresponding piece of the curriculum that corresponds to seminar two. What I suggest you do is to do the exercises and the work pages yourself in addition to maybe reading the curriculum. It shouldn't take that long to go through the curriculum, but I suggest to do the exercises and the work pages yourself, as many as possible, so that you'll get an idea of what it would be like to work with a client in this way and which ones you may want to use with a client. And it'll help illuminate your money story. And knowing our own stories, whatever story or storyline that is, knowing our own story is the very best preparation that we can have to be a catalyst and to facilitate our clients understanding and furthering their story and them telling theirs in their own voice as we've come to know ours in our own voice.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Okay. Other other thoughts or comments? I don't want to inundate you guys with so much stuff, but I'll be sending other material along with the curriculum, white papers that I think might be useful or different aspects. One book that I thought about, this is one of the best accounts of a money story that I've ever read. I was privileged to read it before it came out because this is a buddy of mine. She's a New York Times bestselling author from a number of books and wrote a book about her experience as a Madoff victim. And you know, her book is called Lost and Found. Her name is Jeanine Roth, R-O-T-H. And she's become well known in other areas. But this is, I mean, she's a terrific writer. I just loved her writing. It's really, really well done. And she's so open and honest about her experience and the work she had to do internally on her money story after being a Madoff victim. And it's really insightful. Just Lost and Found, Jeanine Roth, R-O-T-H, in case you have some spare time and some interest in that. Okay?
Okay, I will get that.
Okay, well, we're at our time. I thank you for all of your input and energy. I'm excited about our group and moving forward together. I'm open to any comments, suggestions. We will pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Kim.
See you guys.
Thank you.
Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.